Before the episode today, I want to take a moment and announce that Pat and I have launched a website, acrossthebifrost.com. Now wait, before you fast forward, it's more than just us. We've collected a whole bunch of different content creators, we have a ton of content up at that site, and we're basically using it as a landing zone for anyone looking to explore, listen, watch, read about Marvel Crisis Protocol. You can go to acrossthebifrost.com and get connected with so many different wonderful content creators. So please check out acrossthebifrost.com, give it a subscribe, share it on social media. I will love you forever. All right. Without any further ado, cue that intro music and let's get ready to hear about the X-Men.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up high, there's a
welcome back to the latest episode of Across the Bifrost, and today is a doozy. We have the X-Men, like all the X-Men, not just the stabby boys, Wolverine and Sabretooth, and we are going to try our best to cover the quote-unquote good guys in this episode, the quote-unquote villains in the next episode. But before we dive into that, I'm joined, as always, by my co-host from across the pond, Pat Dunford. Pat, how you holding up?
I am holding up real good, thanks, TT. This is an extra special X-Men day for me because my models arrived today. I have all the X-Men, and I'm assembling them as we speak.
That's amazing. I have no idea when mine are supposed to get here. I also, like, I haven't been super paint motivated lately. I have to kind of reinvigorate that fire. But I'm glad you have your models. I'm happy for you. I finally painted my Kingpin.
Nice. That model is amazing.
It is a gorgeous model. I'm excited to see what some, like, fancier, higher-end painters do with it, if that makes sense. Like, mine is a perfectly solid, serviceable model, but by no means winning any awards.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll look cool all the same. So, we are talking about, like you said, the good guys minus Wolverine, because we covered Wolverine and Sabretooth in our last episode. Who do you want to start with?
Well, I think we should highlight first that there are three boxes we are going to cover, right? We have Cyclops and Storm, Beast and Mystique, and then Magneto and Toad. And we have decided to, instead of doing our normal like box review, we're going to cover the Uncanny X-Men, and the Brotherhood, with the two affiliations out of these three boxes. And I think we should start with the Uncanny X-Men.
Agreed. So we're going to be looking at Beast, Cyclops, and Storm. Okay, I'll start us off then with Beast, going with alphabetical order. Beast is a three-threat character. He's got six stamina and five on his injured side. That's the only difference between healthy and injured. He's a medium mover. He's size three. And worth noting, he's on a 50mm base. That's the medium base. His defenses are four physical, only two energy, and three mystic. And his attacks, his first is acrobatic strike, range three, five dice physical, gives power equal to damage, and on a wild it has ambush. Ambush is, after the attack's resolved, you place the character within range one of the target character. Worth noting with ambush, this is a wild trigger, but it's not optional. So if you roll a wild, you have to get in there, as Beast can get carried away. And his second attack is Animalistic Freestyle. Range 2, 6 dice physical, costs 4 power. After the attack is resolved, you put bleed on the enemy. You get to advance medium, and if you get a wild, you get to push the target if they're size 3 or less. So what do you make of all this, TT?
I don't love any of it, but it's not bad. I don't love the mandatory ambush, right? Mm-hmm. Animalistic Freestyle is fine. It's expensive, but it does give him a free move, which is valuable, right? It reminds me a little bit of Gwen, Ghost Spider. So I don't love any of it, but I don't hate any of it. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, that's totally reasonable. Beast is quite fast, right? Being medium mover on a 50mm base. He's reasonably resilient. 2 energy is a blow, but 4 physical is pretty great. And 11 stamina. And his attacks are perfectly serviceable. In particular, a range 3 5 dice builder on a 3 cost character is pretty good. Right? That's in similar league to, say, Venom. So that's a pretty good builder. His superpowers are very good, in my opinion. First is Baser Instincts. This is a 2 power cost throw. It throws at range 2 Terrain or characters of size 2 or less, short. So it's exactly the same throw as Valkyrie for the same price. His second power is reactive, called Stars and Garters, and it lets him spend power to reroll defense or dodge dice at a rate of 1 power per reroll, up to 3. Then he's got Disconcerting, yet Provocative, which, much like Shuri again, lets him gain power whenever he rolls at least one skull in a dice roll. And finally, he's got Wallcrawler. So Wallcrawler is adding to his mobility. Stars and Garters is adding to his survivability, which are two of his stronger points. And, I mean, a throw's always good, right?
Yeah, a throw's never bad. I like his total package. He just, I don't know what he excels at other than being mobile, right? In my games with him, I've had Acrobatic Strike come up as a negative more than once, and I feel like that's tainted my overall view of him. There are definitely times where I don't want him to move, and then he ends up having a place. I will say, with Ambush plus Animalistic Freestyle and just a normal, or excuse me, he wouldn't have an advance after that, but he'd have the advance off Freestyle. Like he can place himself pretty far, so he can definitely cover some ground. I haven't found a role for him that I absolutely love yet. What about you?
Yeah, so I think you're right that he's a good all-rounder. He's mobile, right? Both of his attacks have mobility attached to them. He's a wall crawler, and he's on a 50mm base. So he's more mobile than most characters. I agree with you that I've found Ambush and Acrobatic Strike to be really awkward, because it's really difficult to be in a situation where you don't mind if Ambush triggers, right? It's often the case that you either really want it to trigger or you really don't want it to trigger, but you don't really have that much control in that. And five dice, it's almost 50-50. It's like a coin toss as to whether it comes up or not. So I agree that that has been a bit awkward on his base attack. Apart from that, though, I found that his throw is really good. This is one of the worst throws in the game, but as we've said before, even a bad throw is still really good. And being able to move characters off points or throw terrain is always helpful. I think one of the things that's interesting about him is he just has a good combination of being fast, tough enough, and flexible enough that you're right, he doesn't do anything especially well, but he's, in my opinion, he's a good generalist in the sense of whatever situation he's in, he has something relevant that he can do.
Yeah, I'm not even gonna disagree with you there. He's a fine, like, well-rounded three-threat character who's rarely impressed me, but he doesn't often disappoint you, right? Like, he'll run around the board, tap some objectives, and, you know, do some damage when he's needed to. I do like his suite of superpowers. Like, I love that he can generate additional power the same way Shuri can. That can end up with a lot of power. He has a way to spend those in Stars and Garters, right, which increases his defensibility. I think Animalistic Freestyle is a little overcosted, right? But that's kind of mitigated by the fact that he has some additional power generation. I do like his strike minus the ambush. So he's got good things on him. I just, in playing him, I have been frustrated more than once. So I like Beast. He's not currently in any roster that I'm testing, is what I'll say.
Oh, I think he's better than that. I think he's worth consideration in a lot of rosters because I think he is more flexible than most three-threat characters, and he can play quite a lot of different game plans fairly well. I mean, the one area that he is not efficient at, especially, is damage. But I think he fits well as just... He's just good in X-Men teams, but I think he's also really relevant in any team that wants to have a character with a throw, right? So, for example, Brotherhood or Wakanda. I think he's got quite a lot of homes.
Yeah, we can circle back to that later. I think in any of those places where you talk about slotting him in, right, he's not affiliated, and there are so many three-threat options. I personally would generally prefer a more focused piece, but if you did want a generalist, I understand his appeal there.
So, as we're talking about Beast in general, right, before moving on to the other characters, and you mentioned unaffiliated, one thing that we found out from Will Schick's stream is Beast is also going to be an Avenger. TT, you like Avengers. How do you feel about Beast in that role?
So we are spoiled with options, is what I'll say, in Avengers. If you wanted to build a more objective-based team with someone really quick, You could run him in Two Widow as it's this interesting five-threat team that's pretty mobile. You could toss in Panther, right, for just another mobile, durable thing. You could end up with something really fast. I could definitely see something going like that. He doesn't utilize the anything they do wonderfully in my mind, right? Avengers Assemble is fine, and we'll get to that. He kind of has like a version of that he has access to innately. He gets a power reduction on Baser Instincts, so he essentially has one power reduction per game round, for all intents and purposes, because it doesn't apply to Stars and Garters. And then Second Wind doesn't really help him, right? I mean, clearing stun's fine, but he's, you know, healing one damage is great. So I think it's fine, but it doesn't jump out as incredible to me. Am I missing something though, Pat?
I think it's just worth mentioning that, okay, saving one power on Baser Instincts maybe isn't huge in the grand scheme of things, but it's a very important point to save, right? Because it means he can be doing his throw every turn, no matter what. And at that point, he's doing a similar thing as Valkyrie is doing in a lot of lists where she's taken. And I think that's pretty strong. I also like his matchup against some of the other three threat characters when they are vying for those points. I think he's a really good model to be out. For example, on the flank of a D map, secure, fighting 1v1 to control points. Because he's tough, he's got that throw, and importantly, he's size 3, so he's quite resilient to a lot of other characters' control effects. So for example, against Valkyrie, she's going to have a really hard time dealing with him because he's 4 physical defense with rerolls. She can't throw him because he's size 3, and he can just throw her every turn and be scoring that point.
Yeah, I do, and that's a good thing to highlight. I'm sorry I didn't mention it. I do like the fact that he's size 3. I think that has some benefit. And for Avengers Assemble with his base size, he does get a little bit of extra movement off the thing. I mean, he might end up being... I don't see him like being earth-shattering in any Avengers roster. I get what you're saying about Baser Instincts. I don't know. It's just a...
Not
doesn't
sold.
Seem as exciting. Yeah, I'm just not quite sold. But
yeah, that's fair. We'll have to see how it plays out.
Yeah, the bigger thing is, like, if he's on the flank, right? Okay, he has Baser Instincts. So you're going to hold Baser Instincts, and the last thing you're going to do is throw, right? So the first thing you have to do is Acrobatic Strike, right? And if you place yourself, your second thing, if you need to get back to that D, has to be in advance, right? You could try to freestyle, assuming you have the power, but Avengers doesn't help you do that, right? And then you're doing a throw. I feel like there are just better models that I can stick out there on the flank. But he is a durable 3-threat character. Certainly no argument from me there.
Durable, and he does have with control.
Yeah, and some unpredictability.
Yeah, that's definitely the biggest issue. And I know we've talked about it already, but I've had very frustrating situations where you want Beast to be at range 3 for Acrobatic Strike, then he doesn't trigger ambush, you can't freestyle, you can't throw. It can get pretty awkward.
Yeah, but I think that's enough about Beast. He's a gorgeous model. Happy he's introduced into the game. Pat seems a little bit higher on him than me, but that's fine. So alphabetically next, I believe it would be Mr. Cyclops.
Sure would. So Cyclops is one of two leaders for the X-Men, the other being Storm, of course. He has 6 stamina on either side. His healthy ninja sides are identical, by the way. He is a medium mover, size 2, costs 4 threat. His defenses are 4 physical, 3 energy, and 3 mystic. So this is all fine, pretty much what you'd expect for a 4-threat character. His attacks, he has Optic Blast, which is range 4, 5 dice energy, gives power equal to damage, and on a wild, pushes characters that are size 2 or less short, so he can't push Beast. His second attack, Optic Devastation, is a beam 5 for 7 dice of energy damage. It costs 4 power, and it has wild concussive force. After each attack is resolved, the target character loses 1 power. So, unsurprisingly, Cyclops is all about those eye lasers.
Yeah, and while he can't push Beast, right? Beast only has 2 defense dice against him. So, Cyclops' attack suites are good, and Optic Devastation I actually like. For a 4-cost spender for a Beam 5, I can get behind that one.
Beam 5 is strong, right? There are not many Beam 5s in the game. The only one I can think of off the top of my head is like Unibeam on Iron Man.
Yeah, and Doctor Strange has one. The falafel.
Doctor Strange has one on a card, and so does, I think, Thor plus Captain America. Thunderwave. But those are on Team Tactics cards. This is a really powerful attack. his powers. Should we look at the leadership later?
Yeah, let's look at the leadership later, because I believe this is also the first time we have to cover what happens when you have multiple leaders in the same affiliation.
Oh, yeah. So maybe we'll talk about that, then look at Storm straight afterwards. So his powers, all of which, in my opinion, are pretty great. The first is Field Leader. This is a 3-cost active power, and it lets you pick another allied character within range 4 and advance them short. You can only move a character once a turn with this, but much like Red Skull, you can move multiple different characters each. Then he's got Hit and Run. We've seen this before on models like Green Goblin. It's a 2-cost power, and as an action, you can make an attack followed by a move. Finally, we've got Quick Draw, which is a new power. It costs 2, it's reactive, and when this character is targeted by an attack and the attacker is not within range 2 of this character, then you can use the power. Instead of rolling dice equal to its defense, it rolls 5 defense dice. Then, if Cyclops takes no damage from the attack, after the attack is resolved, the attacker suffers 2 damage. So this is like martial prowess that we've seen on Gamora and on Proxima Midnight, but for long-range attacks. Martial prowess is attacks within 2, and this is attacks over range 2. All in all, though, these are really cool superpowers. What do you think?
I like the total package, everything you just described. To me, the things that jump out is he is power-hungry, and he is not hurting for ways to use that power.
Yeah. Really power hungry, right? He's got 3 great superpowers that all are fairly expensive. Well, they just add up, right? 2, 2, and 3. And Optic Devastation is a superb attack and costs 4. And 4 is a perfectly reasonable price to pay for it. But when you put all that together, he seems like a model who would benefit a lot either from just a couple of good rolls on his Optic Blast to get power, or other ways that you can give him power through the crises or leadership or what have you.
Yeah, I ran him in Cabal once, and I was quite happy. I don't know what you think about him over there. But yeah, just some way to give him additional power, for me, has been super beneficial. But I like the character. He feels really fluffy. I love the art on the card and the character himself. I really like him.
Me too. I think Cabal is a great pick for him. I think it's interesting to compare Field Leader with Red Skull's ability to teleport people with the Cosmic Cube. They are not the same ability, but from a gameplay point of view, they're very similar. And Red Skull is able to fuel that through spending actions, whereas Cyclops needs to be blasting people to get power, which is sometimes better, sometimes worse, right? Cyclops' best case is going to be a lot better than Red Skull because he can dish out damage as well as moving people around, whereas Red Skull has to choose between those two options.
Yeah, but Red Skull, like you said, has that solid floor of like, it's going to happen, right? Whereas Cyclops, there are sometimes you might roll poorly and you might not be able to field leader. So I like him, though. I think he's a welcome addition to a lot of rosters and a good potential leader for the Uncanny X-Men.
Yeah, so looking at this potential leadership, it's called X-Men Blue. And it is once per turn when an allied character declares an attack action, but before it chooses an attack to use, any number of allied characters within range 3 of the attacking character may spend 1 power. For each power spent this way, reduce the power cost of the attacking character's attacks by 1 to a minimum of 1 for this attack action. So in other words, when you use your spenders, allies within range 3 can contribute 1 power each towards using them.
It's interesting. It's a lot of text, but I think you distilled it kind of nicely. I mean, there is a tactics card that does something similar, right? What is it? No matter the cost or at any cost or whatever, which allows you to take damage to reduce power cost.
Yeah.
So I like it. Your brain kind of goes crazy thinking about like, okay, what spenders can I get off on round 1 or really powerful for me to like drop early in the game? And it definitely makes it easier for him to use Optic Devastation.
Yes. I mean, it's obviously very important that he has a very powerful attack that you want to use because it makes the leadership much more relevant, right? He can be with any characters, and his leadership will be strong just because of him, the character that he is, which is good. I think that one of the challenges with this leadership is the range requirement and the fact that there are not that many characters who have really compelling spender attacks that also are long range. And if you're starting to look at short range spenders, then it might be much harder to have lots of characters within range 3. It also makes me think that to get the most out of this, you maybe want to combo it with characters that are power batteries, so to speak. you know, models like Shuri, Vision, Hawkeye, that tend to generate more power than they can spend. But none of the actual X-Men fall into that category themselves.
Yeah, I think Shuri is the one that immediately comes to mind for me, right? She's one that you want to be within range 4 of anyway. You could sometimes finagle her being in range 3 of people. But then you have to really step back and look at the value of an affiliation and how often you plan on using it, right? Mm-hmm. When I evaluated the Avengers affiliation, right, I said, like, well, he's going to get one power reduction per round, right? And then, like, it's okay, so how many times are you honestly utilizing X-Men Blue? And is that worth building around? Now, the sum of their parts might make it so that X-Men Blue is just kind of a toss-in, right? If you look at the Uncanny X-Men, you determine, hey, these guys are great. Excuse me, guys. These characters are great without an affiliation. I toss this affiliation on. It's fantastic. Then you know what? It's a great add-on. I don't love it as a build-around, though. I racked my brain pretty hard the first time I read it. I've done a bunch of test games with it. I think it's a nice add-on sometimes, but I don't think it's something I want to build a list around.
I agree. My hot take on this leadership is I think it's the worst leadership in the game.
Over Black Order.
Yeah. And I think the victory point gain in Black Order actually is fine. It's rather the... I said that I thought Thanos's back of card leadership was previously the worst in the game. I think this is worse than that. And the core reason I think it's difficult to get a lot of value out of this is the fact it's not saving you any power, right? It's moving power around, but with very limited requirements. You have to be within range, and you have to be making specific attack actions. And the challenge there is you need to have the characters with the power in range of the characters who want to be doing attacks. The fact that you're making attack means that you need your character to be in range of the enemy, and that already adds like a trinity of positions. Right, that you have to adhere to. You have to care about the character making attack, their target, and the person giving them power. And of course, if you're using more characters, then that's even more positioning requirements to get this effect. And the effect of moving power is not that compelling. I think you're right that it's an interesting combo. And if it does let you do cool things, especially early in the game. And there's certain attacks that I think are really good with it. So for example, Punisher's Aimshot, a range 5 attack that adds stun and slow, is awesome to do on turn 1. But I feel like over the course of a game, it's not going to give you a lot of value.
I've beat up Guardians a lot, but I like this more than winging it, and we don't have to go into a discussion about it because I feel like we've had this multiple times. But I do agree with your general assessment of the affiliation. But I do have a question, though, Pat. How does it work if you take two characters, they're both in the same affiliation, and they are both potentially leaders?
So, great point. Can I say one more thing about this leadership before we move on to Storm?
You may say as many things about this leadership as you would like, Pat.
So, one thing I would say is I think this leadership's value goes up a lot on the right crisis. And in particular, when you have crises like Demons Downtown and Gamma Wave, where characters are all incentivized to be near each other, the positioning requirements for this get a lot less, and then it could be more powerful. And in particular, Optic Devastation on Cyclops is pretty awesome on those crises. So I could see a situation where Cyclops becomes your leader specifically with that crisis in mind.
Yeah, I neither one of us think it's a great affiliation. Luckily, they have another one, which we'll get to. It's incredible. Yeah. Uncanny, even. Let's talk about Storm and then let's circle back. Let's talk about Storm. We'll cover her affiliation and let's circle back. I think the biggest problem with this affiliation is it is up against X-Men Gold.
Yes, definitely agree. So, Storm. She is a 3-threat character. Like Cyclops, she is the same on her healthy and injured sides. She's got 5 stamina, medium move, size 2. Her defenses are 3 physical, 4 energy, and 3 mystic. She's got 3 attacks. The first is a lightning bolt. It's a range 4 dice energy attack that gives power equal to damage and on a wild applies shock. Her second is ice blizzard. This is a beam 3 physical attack. Doesn't cost any power but doesn't give you any either. And if you deal damage with the attack, the target character gains the stun special condition. So it's vaguely similar to Loki's Frost Blast. And then her final attack, which is very unique, is Hurricane. This is an Area 2 5 dice physical attack for 4 power. And it's got so many special rules. First one, this attack ignores line of sight and the defending character does not benefit from cover. Second one, after all attacks are resolved from this area attack, each enemy character with the flight innate superpower targeted by this attack suffers 1 damage. So that's extra automatic damage against enemy flyers. And third one, allied characters in range of this attack do not suffer damage from this attack. And just to remind our listeners, in case they forgot, the way that that would normally work is if you're hit by an allied area attack, you just take exactly 1 damage. You don't resolve the whole attack. So in Storm's case, you would have no adverse effects.
That's a lot of powers. It's a lot of attacks. It's also worth noting, I guess, Cyclops is just an X-Men. Storm is an X-Men and a Wakandan.
Yes.
I like Lightning Bolt. Ice Blizzard kind of feels like a toss-in, kind of reminds me of Kane Laser off of Kingpin. Never upset to have a beam. I don't love Hurricane. And I guess my summation is, like, I don't really take Storm for her attacks, but am I missing something, Pat?
No, I think that's fair. All of her attacks are fine, but they're all low power, right? They just don't do that much damage.
Right, but as a three-threat character, I think she has a very reasonable attack suite, and then when we factor in all of her superpowers, which we're about to get to, she's a very compelling character.
Yes, I'd say her attacks are flexible, right? She's got 3 of them, they have different ranges, different area types, they apply different kinds of effects.
And I know it'll come up, but, like, I don't understand why Hurricane has to ignore cover and line of sight, but that's fine.
I mean, it's windy, right?
Yeah, but I mean, it's area 2. Like, I know it could come up, but you get what I'm saying. Anyway, move on.
Okay, so her superpowers. First is Eye of the Storm. This is a 3-cost active power, and it says during her next attack action made by this character this turn, add 2 dice to its attack rolls. This is exactly the same wording as Iron Man's Friday AI for the same effect. This means that with Ice Blizzard and Hurricane, it will affect every attack you make with that beam or area attack, which is very strong. The next one is Tempest. This is a throw. It's a 3-cost throw. It throws enemies or terrain of size 2 or less within range 3, short. Then she's got Goddess of Storms. Characters must be within range 3 of this character to target it with attacks. So it's stealth, but it's not called stealth. So effects that ignore stealth, like Mark for Death, do not work against Goddess of Storms. And then she has Flight and Immunity Shock.
Yeah, so now with that, I'm definitely a little more excited, right? Eye of the Storm, worth noting that same name effects don't stack. You're only ever going to get those additional 2 dice once, if that makes sense, on a singular attack. But yeah, she's definitely more compelling now, right? Tempest is just a slightly better throw than what Henry McCoy has, right? A little bit longer range on the throw for targeting purposes, but same restrictions otherwise.
Yeah, and it costs more power. So it's the same throw as on Spider-Man Peter Parker. It's honestly a little bit expensive. And I'd say if I had to pick the throw, I'd rather have McCoy's. But range 3 is definitely not bad.
Oh, yeah, I would definitely rather have McCoy's too if that was an option. But I think the fact that she has a throw combined with some pretty decent attacks coming in at 3 threat, the same as McCoy's, I think she's a pretty compelling character. I love that she has stealth that's not named stealth. Definitely increases her survivability. And on top of that, right, she has the ability to poke people outside of double attack range, right? She's able to double attack people who aren't able to double attack her without closing the gap. So I like that suite of powers.
Yeah, and I just wanted to emphasize that last point you made. I believe she's our first character who has stealth and also has an attack that is longer than range 3. So she is a first in that she can do that game plan pretty effortlessly.
I honestly don't know. I will believe you, though. That sounds viable.
Yep. Just take my word for it. She's also a first in that she is our first 3-threat character with 4 energy defense, which means she's a pretty interesting inclusion for any team that is going after objectives like spider portals or deadly meteors.
Yeah, so I like her a lot at the 3-threat slot, but she is something else, right? She has an affiliation leadership ability we talked about, X-Men Gold.
Mm-hmm. And oh my gosh, I said I thought Cyclops' leadership was the worst in the game. I think Storm's might be the best. X-Men Gold is once per round, you may use this leadership ability during an allied character's activation if it's not holding an objective token. If you do, choose an allied character within range 2 of the active character. Place the active character within range 1 of the chosen character. So in other words, when your character's activating, they can teleport to one of their friends within range 2, and they get placed range 1 away. But wait, there's more. Additionally, when an allied character is targeted by an attack and the attacker is not within range 2 of the allied character, the allied character has cover. This is just an effect that always applies. Your characters always have cover against every attack outside of range 2. I think this leadership is amazing. It feels like two leaderships in one.
Yes, I agree that it feels like two leaderships in one. I think either one of those in a vacuum would be an extremely strong leadership, right? And we get both of them. So while we both are okay about X-Men Blue, I just don't ever see a compelling reason to take that. Like, why wouldn't I just take X-Men Gold? And Henry McCoy's base size now matters a little bit more, right? So I love this. It really opens up some interesting things. It's really hard for your opponents to plan around because you have so much movement shenanigans. And the counting as cover is huge. It's really, really big in its total effectiveness.
Yeah, it really adds up, right, over the course of the game. And I think there's a lot of interesting synergies that you can consider with this leadership and who you take on your team. I know this is something we're going to talk about in a future episode. We have a plan, Don't Meet TT, to do a big X-Men strategy episode where we talk about team building. So I'm not going to go into it in super detail now because we've got a lot to cover. But I like thinking about, okay, how can I take advantage of this leadership? What characters can punish my opponent for attacking them within range 2, incentivize my opponent to be longer, further range away so that I get cover, and which models most benefit from the additional movement? And like you said, I think large bases in particular get a little bit more out of the teleportation.
Yeah, I love that the X-Men we've covered here, right? Cyclops, Storm, and Beast all have attacks greater than range 2, right? They're all, you know, I don't think we go out of the way to say any of them are extra durable outside of Henry. But you know, adding cover to it is big, right? I mean, when we look at the Web Warriors affiliation ability, right? They get a single reroll and they can reroll failures if they're holding or contesting, right? So a single reroll compared to cover, like obviously, like I'd almost always rather have the cover when outside of range 2. It's just, it's an incredibly strong power.
Yeah, it's not always better, right? The key point is if you're using this, you're not benefiting from cover from other means, right? And if a Web Warrior is themselves in cover, they're going to be more resilient. But I agree with you. I feel like the guarantee of always having cover, if you meet this requirement, is strong and definitely helps the team to survive.
Right, and I'm not saying it's necessarily better than the Web Warriors, right? All I'm saying is that's half of this affiliation, right? And then we have the whole other, like, place yourself within one of a chosen character within two, which is quite a bit of movement.
Oh, it's huge. And it's really important for a lot of early plays, right? Because it lets you do things like teleport, advance, take a middle objective, and then move away, and buys you whole extra actions. Or lets you do things like teleport a heavy hitter forward so they can make more attacks. One thing that's worth noting is both of these leaderships, Cyclops and Storm, require you to be near friends, right? And it seems like X-Men teams are going to need to be using a buddy system where they have at least one friend nearby to leverage their leaderships.
Yeah, but I just think X-Men Gold combined with the rest of Storm's package, she is an incredible leader in a really, 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 really dynamic three-threat character.
I agree. We haven't really talked about what you think of her outside of the leadership. We've gone through what her rules are, but would you take her if she wasn't your leader, for example, in Wakanda?
I think Wakanda Forever is strong enough that whenever they add the Wakandan affiliation to any character, they become a compelling choice. I think she is she has a lot of value coming in at three threat for them. She fits into things that they previously wanted to do, and they've run several three threat unaffiliated characters. I think slotting her in makes them better. I think she's a very powerful Wakandan. What do you think, Pat?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that she's got two free attacks to choose from, right? She's got Lightning Bolt and Ice Blizzard, which are both quite different. And neither of them does a lot of damage, but they both have a chance to apply a different condition. Mm-hmm. So I think she's always going to be helpful with Wakanda Forever. being just three threat and affiliated will make team building more interesting, right? You'll have more options. So that's pretty cool. The big concern I have about Storm, if you're ignoring her leadership, is she has a huge amount of powerful abilities. But to get the most out of her, you need to be using Eye of the Storm or Hurricane or Tempest, and she is not good at generating power. Lightning Bolt is a 4-dice power generator, and she's one of those characters, in my experience, I've played a couple of games with her now, and if she gets lucky with Lightning Bolt and gets power, or indeed if she gets attacked, then her retaliation is excellent. And she has the same thing going on as Iron Man, where if she gets to 3 power, she can use Eye of the Storm to boost her power generating attack, and then she can kind of chain that effect, right? Where she throws 6 dice lightning bolts, gets a couple of power back, and repeats the process, which is really good. So she can have phenomenal games, but she can also have games where she just doesn't have any power in the first couple of turns. Then someone gets close to her, you know, like imagine a Baron Zemo or any short range physical attacker just gets close to her and she just explodes, right? With no defenses at short range. Her leadership doesn't work. Goddess of Storms doesn't work. And she's just 3 physical defense, 5 stamina. And so I've found that my games with her are very variable. Sometimes she's amazing and sometimes she's actually just really bad.
No, that definitely makes sense. But I think that's the role that a lot of 3-threat characters are in, right? A lot of 3-threat characters aren't super reliable or dependable, right? That's one of the trade-offs of coming for that lower threat value. I definitely get what you're saying, and I felt the pain of that 4-dice builder in the past, right? Especially if she has to interact with something on round 1. So she's heading into round 2 with like 0 power, and I'm depending on like double builder to get her some additional power. And sometimes she just flubs that. We talked about Tempest being a little bit, not overcosted, right? But it is more expensive than other throw options for a similar effect. And it's definitely hurt me a lot. I don't find myself using her throw terribly often. And then, like you said, there's a lot of times where I want to take an attack on her. Even if there's a bodyguard nearby, I want the attack because I want the power on her. And it's not out of the question for her to just like fall over and become dazed at any time. So I think she's still a very good 3-threat character. I think she's very compelling. I think if you are worried about her survivability, you compare her with Okoye. She definitely benefits from any incinerates or anything you can toss out there. She does not utilize the Wakandan affiliation very well in my mind either, though, just because of her general power strapness.
Yeah, she isn't going to get much out of King of Wakanda leadership for sure.
No, but Lightning Bolt, she can make really good use out of Shuri's upgrades, right? I mean, everyone in the game does. It's not a very profound statement, but I think she definitely has some synergies with the other Wakandans. I think her, Okoye, and Shuri are a fantastic, interesting package where Storm ends up being a little bit more forward-facing than maybe you'd like, but you can leverage some of your rerolls coming off of upgrades. Okoye can be there to help keep Storm alive. And then once Storm gets rolling, she can kind of turn into the damage dealer out of that group.
Yeah, for sure. And I like that you can take the cheap Wakandans, Storm and Black Panther, and have 4 affiliated characters coming in at only 12 threat. So you, in a situation where you can very easily start to do a wide team with Wakanda, more so than you could do in the past when you had to take Killmonger.
Yeah, for sure. You can definitely end up with something closer to the wide Guardians list that like Sooner ran recently, right? Where it's not unreasonable for you to end up with like 7 characters on the field and still be under the Wakanda affiliation.
Yeah, which is really cool. So I definitely like her. She's a fantastic addition for sure.
Yeah, and we talked about some of the issues last week with Wolverine getting into position, right? And X-Men Gold can definitely help you with that. So I think she's a very compelling leader of the Uncanny X-Men.
I agree. She's a backline fighter, but she's a good one. Shall we move on now to the tactics cards that come with Cyclops and Storm?
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. And I think the first one would be To Me, My X-Men, right?
That's right. That is an active card. A character with an uncanny X-Men leadership ability may spend any number of power to play this card. For each 1 power spent to play this card, 1 allied uncanny X-Men character may advance short toward this character.
So a couple different things to clarify here. First, we know we're going to compare it to Avengers Assemble. We'll get to that in just a second. But Pat, do you have an uncanny X-Men leadership ability even if you are not being chosen as the leader this time?
Yes, you do, and that's really important, right? So if you have Cyclops and Storm on the field, no matter who has been chosen to be your leader for that game, either one of them can play this card and have other people in the team move toward them.
Yeah, and I think that's important to highlight. And while everyone wants to compare it to Avengers Assemble, right, the power spending on each of these are pretty different, right? For here, and to me, my X-Men, a single character, either Cyclops or Storm right now, are spending power to allow other characters to move. For Avengers Assemble, each character is spending to essentially pay for their own move.
Yeah. So Avengers Assemble is a low cost spread across the team and a lot of flexibility in the move. This one is a high cost on one character with less flexibility, but the upside is that you get to move some characters without spending power at all, which could, of course, be really important if you want to use that power for other things. So this card, to me, TT, reminds me of our conversation that we had recently about climbing gear. And I spoke about how I really like climbing gear. It's the card that makes my 8 very often now. And oh my gosh, it's so much worse than Avengers Assemble. But climbing gear has taught me that you can be a lot worse than Avengers Assemble and still be a really good card. And to me, that statement applies to me, my X-Men. I think it's not as good as Avengers Assemble, but I can imagine that it will very frequently get me one or two short advances, and that is well worth a card slot.
I have been critical of Avengers Assemble in the past, is what I'll say. And I think all those criticisms are fair. I am still critical of, to me, my X-Men, but that doesn't change the fact that both of them are very powerful tactics cards. They just maybe aren't as powerful as some other ones. And that's fine, right? I still think it's a very good card. I think it's a card people need to get on the table. I don't think reading it does it as much justice as seeing it in use.
Yeah. I think it's also worth mentioning that you've got to keep in mind that Cyclops and Storm are themselves long-range characters, so they're likely to be behind your team. And although they certainly don't have to be, right? You can position them with this card in mind, and you have a bunch of movement abilities, especially on the characters themselves in like X-Men Gold Leadership and Field Leader and Hit and Run, right? These things might change where they are on the table. But if you don't play with this card in the front of your mind, then you're probably going to find Cyclops and Storm are behind your close-range characters. And so this card is less going to get models like Wolverine into melee, but rather have them retreat out of it and help with kind of a hit and run playstyle.
Hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that's true. There's a bunch of different utilizations for the card, but you do need definitely more planning than you would for like Avengers Assemble, right? Which is like a generic bailout as opposed to me, my X-Men of like, okay, who has the power to spend it and then where are they located on the board?
Yes. But I think it's good. And it's the kind of card where I will happily just use this card to spend one power to move one character into a relevant spot. And for me,
I'm so glad you said that, because I was going to say the same thing, because I do the same thing with Avengers Assemble sometimes, right? There are some games when me using Avengers Assemble to move a single character is worth the card play. So I see a lot of people being like, no, I need to move 5 characters with this, which is great. And a lot of times it provides you value. But stretching or really going out of your way to ensure, you know, I get X movements out of this oftentimes can get you less impactful movements than like one really timely movement. So don't be afraid to use this for like one really important or timely movement during the game.
Definitely agree. So the next card on the list is First Class. This is a reactive card, and it lets you at the start of the activation phase, any uncanny X-Men character can play this card. Each allied uncanny X-Men character does not have to spend power the first time they interact with an objective token this round.
I like the art. I like the old Gimp Suit X-Men picture there. I don't love this card. This card has actually kind of gone down my roster the more I've played it and the more I've thought about it. So how much power do you think this card saves you, Pat?
So that is exactly the question I was going to ask you. And the answer is, the best case is it saves me power equal to the number of uncanny X-Men characters in my squad.
Yep, so 4.
4 at most, right? We've got 4 X-Men. If I take them all, it can save me at most 4 power.
Yeah, so this card is fine. It hasn't been making my 8 lately. I've played with it a decent amount for testing. Again, I was really excited about it, and I've kind of come down on it more and more. The qualifier of it only being uncanny X-Men, the timing isn't my favorite either. I guess I'm less excited about First Class the more I use it.
Yeah, I think it's a solid card. It's one of those cards that's cheap and cheerful, right? The effect is not huge, but it's free, and it's saving you power. And we mentioned already how, in general, the X-Men characters have quite a lot of good ways to use their power and aren't especially good at generating it. So I think in the context of the X-Men themselves, this card has more value because it's ensuring that you have more power to use on turn two, and that could be very important. So I don't think it's bad by any means. I think you need to really consider how you're going to use this and when you want to play this card. I think if this card is in your eight, you don't take it every time in your five. Rather, you look at the table, you think about how many X-Men are actually going to be in your squad, and you decide, okay, can I be sure that all of my X-Men are going to interact? Right? So for example, if I'm playing Infinity Formula plus Montesi Formula, well, then there's only three interactable objectives on the entire table. And if my opponent's going first, they're going to take two of those three. And first class is going to save me one power. And I can't really expect that it's going to get better than that over the course of the game, right? It's unlikely. And what's my best case scenario going to be? All of the books are on the floor and I pick up one and then my opponent picks up one and then I pick up one. Like, it's... So I think this is a situational card. You take it when you have a combination of crises that requires a lot of interaction and you're playing lots of X-Men. Like, I wouldn't take this card if I was running, say, Storm, Beast, and Taskmaster as my affiliated characters.
That's very fair. The thing that I've seen online about this that personally doesn't fit the way I want to play is I have seen people talk about it with Skrulls or alien ships, where they're like, "Look, I'm going to interact with this middle thing four times. I'm not going to care about the power spend." It's not the way I would want to go about it, but it's an interesting mindset. I hadn't considered that.
So I had a game where this came up and my opponent did exactly that. And do you know what happened? They played this card and then they interacted with the scroll and they picked it up. And I was like, well, that's cool. Congratulations. They're like, yeah, I'm kind of happy, but I also wasted this card because all it did was save me one power.
But you could have dazed them and then they could have picked the scroll up again, right? There's so much power saving potential, Pat. So I think first class to me is just like it's great that they have an additional card. It's not. I don't think it falls into my eight. Doesn't sound like it falls into yours either, Pat.
I think this is a card that some people will love, and it reminds me of a card like Hired Muscle, which is at its best on specific crises if you have a plan to use it. And I think some people will legitimately take first class and plan to play missions like Deadly Meteors and Cube Fragments, where there's lots of interactable things on the table and they can really make the most out of it, and that's great. I think it is a legitimate choice that you build your squad with that plan in mind. Is it worth a card? I think that's an interesting question. I think maybe it is worth a card to save three or four power. And sometimes I see people play advanced R&D just to move one power to get an objective. And this is so much better than that I think it has a place and it will see some play.
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to what you could do with Asgard, right? And I'm drastically oversimplifying, right? But in Asgard, you can definitely get an advantage from your characters being able to double interact on round one, and you could utilize first class to have a similar effect, right? So again, if you are putting, what if we do spider portals plus the interactable D that name eludes me at the time, right? That's a lot of different power that you have to be able to spend to interact with things. You might be able to get an advantage early with that and kind of leverage that to a long-term win. So I think with some planning, the card could be usable. For me, it hasn't made my eight, but that's another good point. You definitely need a plan if you're going to use first class.
Yeah. The last card in this box is the third Uncanny X-Men card, Children of the Atom. It's an active card. An Uncanny X-Men character may play this card. It doesn't cost anything. Remove all special conditions from this character. It gains one power for each special condition removed in this way.
I like the card.
Me too.
It's just like solid value. I like it.
It's cheap and cheerful, right? And
going cheap and cheerful.
Yeah, cheap and cheerful.
No, that's fine. I just had not heard that before.
It reminds me of cards like Brace to Impact, which is it has a useful effect that you can expect to want during the course of most games, and it's very cheap to use. And I think, for my money, it might be the best of the three cards in this box. I think it might be the best affiliated card for X-Men.
I think it is by far the one that I will use the most often. I think it has the highest floor, right? I think to me, my X-Men has the highest ceiling. But I like Children of the Atom. I find this in my five. If I'm playing three Uncanny X-Men, then I want to take this card. There's just value in it.
Yeah, and do we think we need to explain a bit more why? Because maybe we're not justifying ourselves very well here.
For Children of the Atom? It's just, I think your Brace to Impact comparison was apt. Never is a very strong term, but I will say it here, and the internet can make fun of me. There is never going to be a game where you don't have an opportunity to use this and receive benefit from it. There's just so many opportunities. We have just annoying special conditions. Hex is a fantastic one to talk about. I never like Hex. No one likes Hex on a character. You never feel good shaking Hex, right? You're just like, waste a whole action just so I can roll criticals again. Like, it just doesn't feel great, right? But Children of the Atom obviously helps you remedy that, right? If you need to be able to shake a stun, I know some of the characters are immune to stun, but if you need to be able to shake a stun before you make a big spender or a big builder attack or something like that, it's a fantastic thing for that. And the fact that there's power tacked onto it as well, it's just a really nice combination. You also combine that with all the conditions that different crises can put out there, and you can end up in a situation where you know that you're going to have one or two different conditions put onto you, right? And then you can just leverage Children of the Atom to give you a slight advantage off that.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the crises because I wanted to bring that up too. I think Children of the Atom incentivizes X-Men to pick those crises, right? Demons Downtown applies Incinerate. Mephisk Witnesses applies Stun. And I think it's pretty cute to be able to set up this card where you're taking those effects and then turning them into power gain on characters who can really leverage the power.
Yeah, so I really like the card. I think it's... When I look at a card, right, one of the things we factor in, and Pat and I have said this, is like, okay, when are you going to be able to use it, right? And like I said, you're going to be able to use Children of the Atom, and it's going to get you something beneficial.
Yeah. There's one other thing that I want to just mention, which is I think the power gain from this card is really key, because in situations where your characters have a lot of status conditions, it is often because your opponent is deliberately trying to reduce the effectiveness of their next activation, right? And often your opponent is trying to put status conditions on them because they don't expect that they have enough damage to be able to daze or KO them, right? And this is going to be especially true with models like Wolverine, because Wolverine's really tough. And a perfectly legitimate way of dealing with Wolverine is to put like a stagger and a shock on him, right? And suddenly it doesn't matter if Wolverine's tough, he's not doing very much. But the fact that this card removes all of those effects and gives you power kind of flips your opponent's strategy. So they intended for that character to be debilitated and have a bad activation, but instead this card has given them a better activation than they would have had if they had no effects on them. And it just acts as a strong disincentive to models like Hawkeye and Doctor Strange of just debilitating characters.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. Hawkeye especially doesn't like it. Even Proxima Midnight, right? I go out of my way a lot of times for the Quantum Starburst or whatever it is, but like that tosses three conditions out there. Do you really want to give them the power from Quantum Starburst plus a potential three power? That's, you know, it's definitely something that you have to factor in when making your attacks.
Right, exactly. And that's a lovely example, because those are conditions designed to limit your power gain. And by putting them all on an X-Man, instead you've just given them three power. It's literally the exact opposite of what you wanted. And that might be enough to stop Proxima ever using Quantum Starburst.
Yeah, so I think if you are still confused, Pat and I both like Children of the Atom. And if you'd like to talk to us more about it, you can on our Patreon Discord. We are happy to talk about this and other things. You can check that out at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. So I think we both agree that Children of the Atom is really good.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
So there's one more card that I guess we cover here. Do we want to cover the crisis now?
So I think our original plan was to cover it in the ACS, but then you cooked up something else for the after-credits scene, right?
Yeah, I generally like us to cover the boxes in the free content, if that makes sense. So yeah, let's just go over it real quick then, if you don't mind, Pat. So we have Mutant Madman turns City Center into Lethal Amusement Park and 18 threats secure. You place four traps, targets of opportunity, indicated on the B map. Each player scores one VP for each trap they control during the cleanup. You may interact with the trap. Roll dice equal to the interactive character's physical defense. If the defense roll contains more good things results than the number of healthy contesting enemy characters, the interacting character now controls the trap. During the cleanup phase, each player controlling a trap chooses an enemy character within two of the trap they control. The chosen character suffers 1 point of damage and gains one power. Resolve each trap completely before moving to the next. So that's a lot of text, but basically you're just kind of controlling like little bombs.
Yeah, I like to think of them as like security turrets, right? You take control of them, then they attack anyone that comes close.
Now, see, I was thinking of them as more like rowdy children, but yeah, sure.
But in any case, I think this is a really, really interesting crisis. It's a B map, so same as Infinity Formula. It's only our second B secure, which is really relevant, right? Because it means if that is a configuration you like, you can now force it in your crisis selection when you have priority. And it's our first crisis that cares about your physical defense when rolling to control the objective. And the ones previously have all cared about energy defense.
Yeah, for sure. We talked about that with our, I can't remember when, I think it was the Punisher Taskmaster box, the characters that have kind of high physical defense numbers. So I think it's definitely an interesting way to play. Another welcome B. I think this is what, the third or fourth 18? So not something new there. But definitely, I like it as a crisis. It was actually really fun to play.
Yeah, I like it too. I think it's really interesting. This isn't maybe a minor point, but it's a slightly different dynamic. So with Deadly Meteors and Spider Portals, which are the other crises we have where you roll to control them, you get punished for rolling skulls. And that means you want to have a high defense to flip something, but the higher your defense is, the more likely you are to be punished. And this crisis doesn't punish you, right? You actually get rewarded for controlling the objective. There's no punishment. So having a high physical defense is even more valuable in this crisis than energy is in those other crises.
Right, and this is another crisis, just an example where if you wanted to try to build around first class, this is another one that I would personally consider.
Yeah, I think it's no accident, obviously, that this crisis is in Cyclops' box, but just worth calling out here, right? You've got first class, so that all of your X-Men can interact with these objectives without spending power, and it requires physical defense, and the X-Men, three of their four characters, have four physical defense. So it seems like they are going to be very good on this crisis.
Yeah, and Storm is the worst, right? And she has three physical defense, which is perfectly fine.
Yeah, no problems there. So I agree. I think this is going to be a popular crisis for a lot of teams, but it does seem really good for X-Men. There's also a bunch of other teams, of course, that have a lot of four physical defense. I just wanted to shout out Spider Foes, because Spider Foes only have four characters, but they are 4-for-4 in having a physical defense stat of four. So I can see this being popular for them.
Yeah, Avengers is another one that I think makes pretty good use out of this. But
Avengers has, what, like 100 characters with four physical defense?
I think it's 72, but yeah, we could double check that later. It's a lot. It's a lot of characters.
Can you name them all if I give you 15 seconds?
No, I could not name them all. I would forget someone. Okay. I'm sorry.
I'm going to try. I think it is Iron Man, Hawkeye, Black Widow, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D., Captain America, Black Panther, and Thor. Probably forgotten someone. It's a lot.
Yeah, the problem is now we have to like remember who we forgot, right? I mean, you forgot Beast, right? We just covered him.
He's an Avenger, and we also know that Wolverine is going to be an Avenger, so that is two more. geez, you can make like two full teams of Avengers that are all four physical defense now.
Yeah, it's a lot. A lot of characters is what we'll say. So
yeah, so I think this is going to be a popular crisis. I think it's really, really cool, and I've also found it's really fun to play.
Yeah, so I think that wraps up our kind of supersized edition, the first half of the X-Men affiliation. If you are a patron, stay tuned for the after the credit scene. This one's going to be a bit more fun, a bit more lighthearted, because we know this episode was coming in a little long. We do want to thank our patrons for supporting us, keeping the lights on, paying for our hosting, and everything like that. And we do generally want to thank everyone who listened. It doesn't really matter if you're a patron or not. We appreciate the listens. Any likes, shares on social media are greatly appreciated. Pat and I love hearing from you guys. You can let us know on Discord or social media what you think. Be sure to check out our Facebook page. You can find Across the Bifrost on Facebook. And then again, our Patreon page, patreon.com/AcrossTheBifrost. So thank you all so much for listening. Pat, thanks for taking the time. Until next time, everyone, cheers and happy gaming.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up high. dreams that you dare to dream really do come.